I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. From needle exchanges to diabetes to the aging brain, a look at research out of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, one of the busiest places in Baltimore. Can mentoring young people help you stay sharp as you enter your 70s and 80s? A new study might make you want to take up volunteering today. Plus, at a time when more cases of diabetes are being diagnosed, just one in three Americans has their problem under control. Why is that such a challenge? And we hear from the Johns Hopkins-based president of the International AIDS Society about the most effective tools in the fight against the spread of HIV. He thinks Congress should lift the ban on federal funding for needle exchanges. First, the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Happy to have you with us. Thanks for joining us and making Midday part of your day. From keeping your brain active as you age, something I'm interested in, to preventing the spread of HIV, in this hour we'll take a look at research out of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, certainly one of the busiest places in Baltimore. We'll be talking to three different researchers from Bloomberg about their work, including one study that scanned the brains of seniors who were mentoring elementary school children in Baltimore City schools to see how their brains did during that experience. But first, we start with Chris Beyrer, professor of epidemiology at Hopkins, who also serves as president of the International AIDS Society. We invited him on the show today to talk about an article that he and another researcher published in the New England Journal of Medicine on the importance of needle exchanges in preventing the spread of HIV and hepatitis C among intravenous drug users. Chris Beyrer is also just back from the 2015 International AIDS Society's conference in Toronto. Chris, nice to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
The article that I alluded to there, in this article, or for the research for the article, you looked at Scott County, Indiana, near the Kentucky border, a place that saw a huge increase in HIV and hepatitis C infections. The county went from seeing about 5 new cases of HIV a year to, as of this June, hitting 169 new diagnoses in about a half a year. And more than half of those infected people were also diagnosed with hep C. So in response to this, very interestingly, the governor of Indiana, Mike Pence, declared a health emergency.
Yes.
And permitted local jurisdictions to temporarily establish needle exchange programs. Indiana is one of 25 states, and I was surprised to see this, 25 states where needle exchange programs are illegal. In fact, 25 states where you can't get an over-the-counter syringe unless you have a prescription. Is that right?
That's right.
So tell us what happened in Scott County. First of all, what accounted for that increase in HIV?
Well, Scott County is an important example, unfortunately, of a trend that we're seeing in many places in the country, particularly in the states around Indiana, where Scott County is, Kentucky, West Virginia, which is that the face of drug use is changing. It's more rural and suburban. About almost half the cases in Scott County were women. The new infection, so it's more in women than the predominance in men that we used to see, moved out of the inner cities and moved out into new areas where people are using injection drugs, particularly heroin, and where, unfortunately, as you alluded to, the legal and policy public health programs are not in place to help people avoid HIV and hepatitis C infections. So needle and syringe exchanges don't exist. In Indiana, carrying a needle and syringe without a prescription is a felony with up to 3 years incarceration. And also, drug treatment programs that can help people who are dependent on opiates are very hard to access and are very limited. Of course, these are all red states that also have not expanded the Affordable Care Act, which has drug treatment provisions as part of it. So you have, in a way, a perfect storm. There's no needle and syringe exchange. There's an increase in substance use, and particularly in injection use of heroin. There's a lack of services for drug treatment. And the hepatitis C epidemic there actually began in 2011, So that was the time to intervene and prevent this outbreak.
Needle exchanges. That's in Baltimore. This is an old debate that was settled some years ago, and we have a needle exchange in the city for, I don't know how many, more than 20 years now, I think. So because we had a heroin problem, HIV problem before it hit these areas. So do you think, I mean, it's one thing to hear a governor declare a state of emergency. It's another thing to formulate policy that is sustaining.
That's right.
Right?
That's
right. That provides treatment to people. Do you think that's going to happen?
Well, first of all, he has to be given some kudos for courage.
Yeah.
He's a Republican governor, and this policy of opposing needle and syringe exchange, making it illegal, has been a strongly held view by many in the party and many in the Congress, unfortunately. The scientific evidence is abundantly clear. Baltimore's a great example. HIV rates are quite low in injectors here. The Hopkins cohort study that's been going on for many years documents that very clearly. Governor Pence, did respond initially just for 1 month. Then he extended it in Scott County for another month. Now the other counties in the state, if they can show that they also have a public health emergency, can also start needle and syringes. But rather than being an emergency response, this should be a basic part of public health.
Well, let's talk about that. You mentioned Congress. Do we have federal funds available for needle exchange programs?
So we have had a federal ban on funding of needle and syringe exchange programs.
A complete ban.
A ban for many, many years. President Obama was the first to lift that ban. He successfully did that early on in his administration. The pushback from the House was just enormous, particularly the conservatives in the House. And eventually they threatened to defund a whole array of other HIV programs. And so rather than risk that, the president reinstated the ban. So it is active. In most cities and states where needle and syringe exchange does exist, and Baltimore is a good example, city and state funds have been used. So the ban really only applies to federal dollars. But of course, that still has had a very negative impact. Perhaps one of the worst examples of that is the District of Columbia, where because the Fed controls there, they don't have a state budget in essence. They were very, very slow to get needle and syringe exchange going. And of course, they have one of the highest HIV burdens of any city in the country.
I want to walk back over that just for a moment and reflect on that. So the argument against government-sponsored needle exchanges is that what encourages use of opiates, encourages use of heroin?
Well, that's
the classic argument against it, right?
That's right. And the argument essentially is something like, if you provide needles and syringes to people, you're tacitly approving of their substance use. You might even be encouraging substance use, or you're somehow subsidizing substance use. The fact is, the data show the exact opposite. So one of the things about needle and syringe exchanges is that the people who are using drugs the most are the most likely to use the exchanges. And it's hard to reach those people, and it's hard to build trust with them. Needle and syringe exchange is a way to do that. You engage people where they are. You can help people get into treatment when they're ready. You provide them a service that they want. You build trust. You keep communication open. And you can also help people get testing for HIV and hepatitis C, which are the two most important infections associated with sharing dirty works, dirty equipment. And that's critically important because hepatitis C now is curable with a short course of oral therapy. And of course, we know from HIV that if you don't diagnose HIV infection and treat people, they remain infectious. And if you do manage to get them into treatment, into care, and on therapy, they're much less likely to pass the virus on. So there's a public health element to this, too, as well, Dan, and that's really important.
Chris Beyer, associated with the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, where he's a professor of epidemiology, also the Johns Hopkins Center for Global Health, correct?
Yes.
And now serving as president of the International AIDS Society. I assume the IAS supports lifting this federal ban on needle exchange funding.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So maybe you should get to Congress, or perhaps you've already been there. Have you been there to testify about this?
Many a time.
Many times.
And it's been a long struggle. Of course, we were delighted when the president lifted the federal ban, and very disappointed when the administration was really forced to capitulate to the Congress.
Well, that's where I wanted to walk back there for a minute. So the argument is don't give out needles to people because it will just it condones the use of heroin. Meanwhile, we're not going to expand health care to people. Let the Democrats do that so that we can get more treatment to people for their heroin addiction, right? So,
I mean,
there's a conflict there.
Yeah, there absolutely is. I mean, the cornerstones of a public health response here, what we want to see is, first of all, that people have access to clean needles and syringes. That's very important. That's just basic public health. And the evidence is very clear that that does not increase the number of people injecting in fact, quite the opposite. It is a gateway into treatment. The second is that there has to be evidence-based, effective drug treatment on demand. And there are a number of options. There's methadone. There are other substitution therapies.
Buprenorphine
Buprenorphine, exactly. Which not only can reduce injection use and needle sharing, but which have been shown in very well done studies, including work done by my colleagues here in Baltimore, reduces crime, has very positive impacts on employment, on getting people back into education. It stabilizes people's lives. It has a positive impact on the community in reducing the kinds of opportunistic crime that people who are dependent on drugs often engage in. And then the third element is treatment of their HIV, their HCV, which is really critical.
Chris, I came across your name in an article in a Canadian magazine about a place in Vancouver that it was stunning to me. Mm. I've never heard of it's not a needle exchange place.
It's a safe injection facility.
Safe injection facility in Vancouver, a place called Insight, where people can go and safely inject themselves with illegal drugs, right?
That's right.
It's the only place of its kind in North America.
That's right. That's right. And it's had a struggle. It actually went to the Canadian Supreme Court to fight for the right to provide this service, which the court agreed that they were able to do. The basic idea is Vancouver has one neighborhood, the East Side, which has a long concentrated population of people who use drugs, a lot of homeless folks, a lot of indigenous, aboriginal Canadians are in that mix. And there were many, many overdose deaths, and of course needle sharing use of unsterile equipment. So the idea of Insight is basically to provide a safe place for people to come where they can get clean equipment, they can inject safely, and where there are medical professionals on hand so that if people do overdose, it can be reversed quickly. And lives can be saved in that way. And this is probably one of the best studied facilities in the world because the Canadian...
I was going to ask you, what is the evidence that it's of its effectiveness?
Yeah, the evidence really very extraordinary. So, of course, there has been dramatic reductions in HIV and hepatitis C. More importantly, in the area right around Insight, which is kind of the hardcore center of this drug-using scene, there's been a dramatic reduction in overdose deaths. That's really been a critical outcome. Many thousands of people or thousands of injections happen there. It's a busy place.
Excuse me. Can I ask you what that might mean about the overdose? What do we construe from that? That people are bringing better heroin into the facility?
No.
Or that if they do overdose, there's help for them immediately?
That's exactly
it. Is that it?
That's exactly it. So there's no decrease in the number of overdose episodes.
Okay.
There's a huge decrease in the number of overdose deaths.
Deaths. All right. Right. And this is run by the government or is it a nonprofit? Who runs Insight?
It's run by the community. It's supported by the city of Vancouver. The city and the province have both been supportive. It's been the Canadian federal government who's had problems with this and tried to close it down.
Chris Beyer, it's nice to have you on the show here, even for a brief time. Tell us a little bit about the International AIDS Society, where the big picture with AIDS in the world today.
Yeah.
Just briefly.
we just had our big scientific conference, as you said. It was in Vancouver, actually, which is why we were at the InSight site. About 6,000 or so participants from 125 countries. Tremendous amount of science. But the big news was, and really very important news, was the evidence from the START trial, a 36-country study, which showed that early treatment really is better and reduced the number of clinical events like a hospitalization or an AIDS-related infection or cancer by over 50%. So the message really is that as soon as people are diagnosed with HIV, they need to be offered therapy and to start therapy as soon as possible.
As soon as they're diagnosed. Some go quite a while before they are diagnosed,
right? That's
right. We're seeing this especially among young people.
That's right. And in many developing countries, they're still using old guidelines where, for example, you have to have below a certain immune threshold. That's very dangerous. The WHO, the World Health Organization, is going to change its recommendations based on this new science. That's going to happen in the next few months. And that's going to mean that something like 22 million people worldwide are going to be now eligible to start antiviral therapy. That's a huge increase. We don't have the resources right now. We're going to need to look for those resources. But that could really be a game changer in the global epidemic. And in the U.S., you know, right now, the estimate is that only about 30% or so of Americans living with HIV are successfully treated and are virally suppressed. So we have a long way to go in this country. We need to get that much higher. And we need to do a much better job of both finding people who are living with HIV and who are not diagnosed. You see that particularly in young folks and in young gay and bisexual men. And we need to do a much better job of getting people who have had a diagnosis fully treated.
And one last question about stopping its spread and needle exchanges. What would it take to get Congress to lift this ban on funding of needle exchanges?
Well, we think this outbreak in Scott County and in the surrounding states has really changed the discussion in Washington. Mike Pence, you know, stood up to his party and basically lifted the ban for Indiana, at least. A number of other states now are in the position of having to debate that. And there seem to be some reasonable public health-oriented Republican voices saying it's time to rethink this. So unfortunately, you know, sometimes out of a public health disaster comes change.
Chris Byra, a professor of epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and president of the International AIDS Society, chairing the next conference in 2016, right? In South Africa.
That's right. In Durban, South Africa.
Nice to have you on the show today.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, folks, just one in three American seniors has their diabetes under control. We'll hear more on that study after this break here on the Midday Show. And we'll meet a recent graduate of Baltimore Polytech Institute, Baltimore Poly, who helped crunch the numbers on that Bloomberg study. So please stay with us. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here in this hour taking a look at new research out of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, a program that we produce here for you from time to time because there's so much going on over there at Bloomberg. So we pick a few studies to take a look at. With us now is epidemiologist Elizabeth Selvin. She has a study to share with us about older Americans and diabetes. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimate that about 11 million Americans age 65 or older have diabetes, either diagnosed or undiagnosed, but how successful are they in managing those conditions? That's what Liz Selvin looked at in her study. Liz, nice to have you on the show again, I should say.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you in the studio with us. Also with us today is Ina Rastegar. Ina just graduated from Baltimore Poly. She spent about 2 years working on this study with Liz. Is that right?
Absolutely.
That's great.
Fantastic having her.
So, Ina, we'll hear from you in just a minute about how this worked out for you. This was part of the Ingenuity Project in Baltimore City, right?
That's right.
You were enrolled in that. Nice to have you on the show.
Thanks.
So, Liz, I mentioned 11 million Americans age 65 or older. Some of the reports in the last year or so about the increase in diabetes, I see numbers from 26 million to 29 million 9% of the population now, something like that. Am I in the right ballpark?
Yep.
Well, what's going on there?
Well, I mean,
why is this happening? I guess I'll start with that question.
So the primary driver is the obesity epidemic. So we've seen a doubling of the prevalence of diabetes in the population over the past couple decades, and that's really coincided with trends in obesity. So most of the cases are being driven by overweight and obesity.
And we've seen it affecting all age groups now, too, right? Even children under 14?
Absolutely. That's, yeah.
Yeah. How do you know if you have diabetes? I mean, if you don't mind a question like that, like what is a symptom of diabetes? Obviously, if you have a blood test, a doctor can tell you whether you have the high glucose or not. But
so some people, you know, who don't get tested and don't get their glucose measured might become symptomatic, and you know they might experience weight loss, then they might get thirsty and pee a lot. But that's really, most people are being identified earlier before they're symptomatic. So in the asymptomatic stages, people are getting screened, they're getting their glucose measured, they're getting their hemoglobin A1C measured by their doctor, and they're getting identified earlier.
Okay, so that's a good thing.
That's a good thing.
but the numbers, that explains some of the numbers too, right?
Well, I mean,
and then there's undiagnosed is part of this as well.
Exactly. The good thing, we have made a lot of progress over the last two decades in identifying diabetes earlier. So the good news is the proportion of people who are undiagnosed has actually decreased over time. So the fraction of people who are walking around with undiagnosed diabetes is actually fairly low.
Epidemiologist, if you don't mind me asking, since you do this kind of research, how do you know, how do you come up with a number for an undiagnosed diabetes?
So we work with large studies that select people from all over the country, and they draw their blood and collect their urine, ask them questions, get a complete medical history, and then we use those data to extrapolate to the general public.
And we're talking about a large study here.
Yeah.
This is the ARICS. What does that stand for again? The ARIC.
This is the ARIC study, the Atherosclerosis Risk and Community Study.
Thank you for pronouncing that. This is like almost 16,000 middle-aged Americans who've been studied since the 1980s, am I right?
Exactly. So the first visits were in the late 1980s, and we enrolled 15,792 people, and we've been following them for over 25 years now.
Including here in Maryland.
Including here in Maryland. Our center here is in Hagerstown, Maryland. And we recently completed a new visit, and almost 7,000 people came to this visit across our four centers across the United States. And now everybody was middle-aged in the during when we originally enrolled them. So now everybody is basically 70 or older. So now we have a cohort of older Americans. So we can look at health conditions important to older adults. And this study, we're particularly interested in diabetes.
Okay. So in this study, you wanted to see how people were managing their diabetes.
Exactly.
How did you go about this?
So we looked at how well diabetes was controlled in this cohort of people. We looked at the ABCs, as we call them. So A stands for A1C, or hemoglobin A1C, which is a marker of blood sugar control.
Mm-hmm.
And then the B is blood pressure. And then the C is cholesterol, the ABCs.
So you're expected to manage all three of those things, right?
Exactly. And I'll say that characterizing these risk factors and control of the ABCs in older adults is particularly important because treatment targets, or how low the levels of A1C and blood pressure should be in older adults, is quite controversial. And
some people think they're too stringent.
Exactly. And that's because the evidence for how tightly to control diabetes comes largely from studies of middle-aged adults. And so we don't know how well those results apply to older individuals. And so there's lots of concern about whether we're too tightly controlling diabetes in older adults by applying evidence from studies of middle-aged adults to this older population.
So people go to their primary care physician, right? And they get these numbers, right? They get the hemoglobin number, they get the A number, the blood pressure. They know what they're dealing with blood pressure. That's more commonly known, what the expectations are anyway. And cholesterol, your doctor will tell you about that too. And then you're expected to sort of manage, I use the word manage or control, all three of these things, right?
Yep.
To a level that keeps you healthy. The consequence being, if you don't, what are the consequences? You get dizzy, you can die.
Well, so right? the original guidelines, the evidence from that is really about the long-term consequences of diabetes. If you don't control your glucose, you can develop kidney disease in the long run. You can develop eye disease, nerve damage, but all of these complications can take years to develop. And so in older adults, we may be more concerned about the immediate effects of the drug treatment to lower the glucose, to lower the blood pressure. And so we have to weigh the sort of immediate and harmful effects of the tight diabetes control with the benefits of which are largely longer term.
Hmm. So what did you find when you looked at these three measurements?
So what we found is that only about a third, or 35% of our study population, had all of their risk factors tightly controlled. So very few older adults had all risk factors meeting stringent guidelines.
Okay. So in some categories, they did better than in others?
In some categories, they did
like
better than others.
Controlling cholesterol, how did that compare in your group to the first measurement, the hemoglobin A1C?
Yes, so cholesterol was tended to be better controlled, and the A1C and the blood pressure were less well controlled. And then we also saw differences in whites and blacks, which was quite concerning.
A racial disparity?
Racial disparities. One of the characteristics of the ERIC study is about a quarter of the participants are African American, so we're one of the few studies that can really compare differences in black and white adults in the United States.
And how did it break down?
So blacks, especially African American women, were much less likely to have all of their risk factors controlled. And we can't really explain why in this particular study, but it means that African American women are being treated differently. Their diabetes is being managed differently, and you know, I think that really gets to the point that we need to make sure that everybody is getting the appropriate care and that everybody is seeing their physician and their diabetes is being managed appropriately.
So explain that. You mean you don't think they're accessing healthcare as well as white women?
Well, I mean, we did a lot of, we have a lot of information on these people, and even when we controlled for education and access to care and other factors, we still saw these disparities. So we don't know exactly what's going on, but I think it really does emphasize the need to make sure that everyone is getting the right access to care and that physicians are treating all their patients appropriately.
I want to ask Ina Rastegar about this now. It's interesting you brought Ina with you today. So she's an embryonic researcher, maybe for Bloomberg someday.
Yep.
Ina has just finished high school. And by the way, what are your plans for the fall?
I'm going to be a student at Carnegie Mellon.
Oh, okay. And are you considered a math whiz because you were in the Ingenuity Project, right?
I guess.
Yeah. You like math.
Yeah.
So how did you get involved with Liz's study?
So there's a class at Poly that you take for Ingenuity that hooks you up with a research mentor if you're interested. And I guess my research advisor knew Liz, and so he made that connection for me.
Hmm. And what did you do? Did you actually go over to Bloomberg?
Yeah.
Into a, well, if not a laboratory, in front of a computer
right.
to do some of this work, right?
Right.
Yeah. And the assignment, it sounds complicated to try to figure out how people are managing these different measurements, right? These different health measurements. So how did you do that exactly? I mean,
yeah. So I'm really proud of this project.
Do you get doctors' reports on individual patients, or do the patients report to you?
So we have lots of data. So the participants come into the clinic, and we draw their blood, and we get complete medical history on all of the participants. And then Ina was very fortunate to look at these mountains of data.
Yeah.
And so she worked very closely with Christina Perinello, one of my PhD students, and Ina learned a lot of advanced statistical programming and ended up doing a lot of the statistical analyses for this project. And she actually won an award at the Baltimore City Science Fair for this work.
Oh, is that what the award was for? I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, that's what it was for.
Good for you. So once you got into it, you really liked it.
Yeah, I learned a lot, and it was a really great experience.
And did you get some credit for doing this? Is that all part of the Ingenuity Project?
Right.
At Poly? Well, good for you. And then you're off to Carnegie Mellon? Which one are you going to? Carnegie Mellon or Carnegie Mellon? Do you know which
Carnegie.
One? You're going to Carnegie?
Yes.
Liz, which one did you go to? Oh, no, you didn't go there, did you?
I did not go to Carnegie or Carnegie Mellon.
Did you talk to patients about why they're having trouble managing all this? They think the standards are too hard to meet. What do people say, or what do you speculate?
So that's the big question. So yeah. Older adults are not meeting diabetes treatment targets. So it's not clear if they're being undertreated or if possibly not meeting these targets is actually an appropriate response to the risks of treatment, because the risks of treatment are very real and they are exacerbated in older individuals. So if you aggressively treat glucose, you can get hypoglycemia or your blood, you know, abnormally low blood sugar. And that's very dangerous, but it's a very common side effect of glucose-lowering treatment. And older adults are particularly vulnerable to abnormally low blood sugar.
Mm-hmm. Does that mean they're worried about that? Or they?
And
they don't take the treatment? Or?
So certainly you can get lack of adherence because of concerns about hypoglycemia. In older adults, you can have poor kidney function, and that means that medications don't work quite the same as they do in middle-aged adults. And so if your glucose gets too low, you know, this can cause fainting, confusion, seizures, even death. So balancing the immediate harmful effects of glucose-lowering treatment with the benefits, which are largely long-term, is what's really the major controversy in older adults right now with diabetes.
72% met the hemoglobin A1C levels. That's pretty good, isn't it? Or not? 72%?
That means 30% of people are not meeting certain targets. It really depends on whether the people who are not meeting the targets, whether it's okay for them to have slightly higher hemoglobin A1C levels.
In terms of lifestyle, which ones are, I won't say, are easiest to reach? Maybe that isn't the word to maintain, but the ones, is cholesterol the one that people seem to be doing better at because it's mostly about diet and exercise? And
the medications are very
the medications.
They're very safe. Okay. They work very well.
Okay. They don't have the side effects that people might worry about. This is very interesting. So what happens now? I'm curious about that group, the ARIC group, or ARIC, A-R-I-C group, that was 15,792 middle-aged people in 1987, right? So I guess as time goes on, the group gets smaller. You ended up dealing with how many folks in the
group? So about 7,000. So many more are still alive. We didn't get everybody back to the in-person visit come in and get their blood drawn and get all the medical history questionnaires and the examination.
I had a question that came in, or a comment by email from one of our listeners, Teresa. She says, I'm a type 2 diabetic, diagnosed in 2011. I think a lot of boomers suffer from depression from various causes, getting older, living in a society that worships youth, financial concerns as we approach retirement. I am 57 years old, and frankly, food is my only remaining pleasure, so when the doc tells me to eat no sugar, I am not inclined to listen to that. Food is the only item in my life that I feel I still have complete control over. Please discuss the emotional, mental aspects of dealing with type 2 diabetes.
I mean, that's a wonderful comment. I mean, there are major emotional issues dealing with type 2 diabetes. Depression is very common in type 2 diabetes and can really complicate the management of the disease. And certainly people's relationship with food and restricting food can be quite hard. But we know that just a little bit of weight loss, increasing physical activity can be very effective at improving glucose control and improving long-term outcomes.
Let me ask you a question about the study, the results of it. After you do all this work, you listen to Liz Selvin explain the results, what do you think is the value of it? What comes out of this for you? What would you say to people? Why did you do that work? What's the value of it?
I mean, I think that at least right now, diabetes is a very big issue in the U.S., and I think that this study would sort of help people understand what they need to do if they're diabetic, and also help physicians assess their patients and stuff like that. Yeah.
How about you, Liz? We're always talking about public education. getting people to pay attention. I mean, most people do listen to their doctors, don't they? It's just hard to maintain these regimens that are necessary in lifestyle and medication to achieve all of this.
Yeah, so it's a real balance. I mean, I think one of the key messages is that older adults with diabetes, they're a very heterogeneous group. And so we need to make sure that physicians are working with patients to come up with individual care plans and really addressing the specific needs of each patient, because those needs may change as people get older, and reevaluating and really treating each individual because each person's circumstance, particularly in older adults, might be quite different. And, you know, I think what we really see from this study is that the risks of diabetes medications in some patients may outweigh their benefits, especially in older adults. And so it's a very careful balancing act.
You mentioned racial disparities. And did we talk about gender disparity? How did it break down gender-wise?
Not much evidence for gender disparities.
Okay, men and women. But only about 1 in 3 adults, though, are able to manage their diabetes. Older adults. Liz Selvin, it's nice to have you on the show. And congratulations on this research, and off to the next project, right?
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And we're going to take a break here on the midday show as we look at research out of the Bloomberg School of Public Health. When we get back, brain imaging reveals that volunteering your time, mentoring young people, staying engaged in your community, even as you hit your 70s, your 80s, maybe your 90s, you can retain your memory, your cognition. You're gonna do better in life if you volunteer your time. I think that's the upshot of this study. We'll get into it when we get back. A short break on midday. Please stay with us. And welcome back to Midday. We're taking a look at new research out of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health over there on Fayette Street. Oh, Broadway.
That's
Fayette, yeah. Michelle Carlson is with us now, an associate professor in mental health over there. She's also a core faculty member at the Johns Hopkins Center on Aging and Health. Michelle, nice to have you on the show with us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, this is an interesting study that I teased there a little bit. You followed participants in the Baltimore Experience Corps, a program that matches retired residents to Baltimore schools so they can help children learn to read and other things. These are people who've achieved things in life, you know, had a career, retired, and just want to share some of their knowledge with young people, right? And actually mentor them.
That's correct.
Yeah, we had a couple of guests on this show within the last year from the Baltimore Experience Corps. So tell us about this study. How did you get interested in this subject? What were you looking at here?
Well, thanks for having me. Yeah. And also, our volunteers are our best ambassadors and recruiters to the program, which is ongoing in 30 schools across Baltimore City.
Is it really?
With 300 volunteers. So it's been active and engaged, and really we're excited to see it continue that way with AARP.
Now, Experience Corps started in not just only Baltimore, I think it was in Philadelphia too, right?
It's national, so it has multiple sites, and among them was Philadelphia, one of the earlier sites. The program started in the 1990s and essentially has grown under both sort of a partnership between nonprofit and research. And I got involved as a postdoctoral fellow here at Johns Hopkins with my mentor then, Linda Freed, and our goal was to think about how to evaluate the impact of civic engagement, and it's really harnessing the lifetime of accumulated knowledge of our older adults and harness that knowledge and give it back to a younger generation in need, because we could see that our city schools needed more resources to help teachers and at this critical window of development at grades K through 3.
So you wondered if this is good for the mental health of the volunteer.
Right. Mental and physical health. So thinking about, you know, the older, the retired adult, and thinking about engaging them to give back a lifetime of knowledge, and in doing so, maybe by helping others and being socially engaged and physically active by getting out into the schools, that they would be helping themselves at the same time. So a win-win.
Okay, so you wanted to do an evaluation of some kind. So what brought you to brain scans?
Well, I was listening to our volunteers. So I started under the idea and some work I'd been doing showing that one of the most important abilities that begins to decline with age is our executive functions. And then we also are interested in memory because memory changes occur, you know, in our 50s. And so I wanted to see whether or not engagement in this complex school setting might actually help exercise parts of our mind and our brain that might help buffer us with aging and buffer us and protect us against risk for dementias like Alzheimer's disease. At that time, we started with cognition, with executive tests, like looking at planning and problem solving. And we showed some changes related to being in the program. The volunteers who had been in the program relative to matched controls were showing improvements in executive function and memory. And so we thought, that's exciting. And I was listening to volunteers, and they said to me, literally, this program is removing the cobwebs from my brain. Hmm. And I thought, that's exciting. Let's try. Let's test that.
When you say executive function, what's an example of that for our listeners to understand?
Good question. What is? It's everyday life. It's changing your plans, adapting to a changing situation. You get a flat tire, or you run out, managing your medications, driving, stopping at the stop sign, any situation that requires you to kind of collect a lot of information and make a decision, an informed decision, is important. And it's called executive function because you're essentially taking updating information and making a decision to either go left or right based on the information in front of you. So you're using executive function all the time to moderate your life.
And how do you test it or measure it? In this trial, how did you do that?
That's a good question. We use tests that are what we call neuropsychological tests that are adapted to test components that, including shifting, your ability to shift your attention, your ability to inhibit one response you're used to in favor of another. So, for example, you're used to reading, but if we ask you not to read a word, but rather to name the color of the word, that slows you down. You have to stop because that's not a practiced ability. Your ability those are important abilities related to executive function that we test. And then in daily life, we think about how those translate to these everyday functions that I mentioned.
Okay. All right. So tell us about the group you studied in this trial. So how large a group was it?
In the larger trial, the trial we concluded recently, the Baltimore Experience Corps trial, started with 702 adults randomized to either be volunteers for 2 years or to be waitlist controls for 2 years. And we followed them annually.
Excuse me. Did you say waitlist controls?
That's right. That's right.
I'm sorry. I don't know what that means. You mean they didn't do anything?
They lived their lives. We referred them.
They didn't volunteer. They weren't part of
that's
this.
That's right.
Okay.
They were part of it. They were essential because what they were willing to do is to be randomized to be followed so that we could look at the effect of being in the program versus essentially living your normal life.
Yeah.
And we referred them to other volunteer opportunities that were of lower intensity, maybe 1 to 2 to 3 hours a week.
Okay. As far as the Experience Corps goes, what do you have to do in Baltimore Experience Corps that makes it more intensive than some other volunteering?
So with the Experience Corps, it's unprecedented, really, in thinking and asking volunteers to commit about 15 hours a week.
15?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the important reason for this was because we wanted to make sure that we understood in meeting with principals that we needed to have a steady, consistent presence of volunteers. Kids need consistency. And what we would do is we would recruit adults in teams to work 15 hours a week so that they would have a kind of a critical mass to be able to make a difference and help children across these grades and see if we could really impact their reading levels.
So they worked on reading mostly?
Reading and mentoring. And so
these are elementary school kids.
Right, in kindergarten through third grade. And so we actually, it was reading, it was library support, learning the Dewey Decimal System. It was helping them to communicate positively through eye-to-eye messaging versus you this and you that. And also through essentially modeling, you know, just sort of modeling and showing affection and attention and care for the child's progress and believing in them. Some things we couldn't train them to do. Some of our volunteers just kind of understood what kids need and they nurtured them. And we've seen these children thrive going beyond grades K through 3 to now after school programs and pre-K programs.
So they really got to be engaged. There's the word there. They're engaged.
Absolutely,
with these kids. Okay,
100%.
And the folks all knew that they were going to be part of a study group too.
Right? They did. They committed.
And so how long did you study them?
For two years. Again, for a trial-based design, this was unusual. Most trials that look at impact of any kind of program on an older adult are usually 6 months to 1 year. And this was a two-year commitment over two academic years. And we evaluated them before they started and then at 1 and 2 years to see what kind of an effect this program was having on their cognition, on their memory.
So you had a baseline.
A baseline.
So you study their brain. Did you look at their brain before they started?
We did.
And then you looked at the brain at the end of the 2 years?
And in the middle.
And in the middle.
In the middle.
Can we go to the brain part now? Because I like this.
Sure, sure.
So you actually did scanning of the brain.
We did. And when we did that, one, our volunteers loved both the controls and the participants loved getting a picture of their brain. They knew how important it was to see if they were showing brain changes. And we looked at baseline, 1 year and 2 year, and found duration or dose-dependent changes in the experience core volunteers relative to the controls. And these changes were in regions of the brain that are important to memory and Alzheimer's disease risk.
Excuse me. I had to ask you again about another term. Did you say dose-dependent?
I did. Sorry.
Do you mind explaining that?
Sure. So that means that when you look at, for example, drug trials, you look at dosage and then you see, you know, if you see an effect related to the dosage. In the same form here, we looked at exposure and we found that the longer one was exposed to the program, the better, the greater the benefit to their.
Really?
Yeah.
So the more they were around elementary school kids and engaged with them, helping
them
with their reading after school?
Mostly in the school.
In the school during the school
during
day.
During the school hours, so we didn't disrupt the child's usual school day.
So if you had a good dose of that, you're going to do better.
Over time. And it took time. So the program benefits developed over time. If we had discontinued the program at the end of the first year, we wouldn't have seen the degree of benefits we saw that continued to accrue through a second year of program participation.
So being on campus, meaning the elementary school,
right,
is good for your hippocampus. Am I right? How's that,
that's
Michelle?
Good. I
How'd
love
I
it.
Give me a
high five
on that.
Is that
true?
Is
what I just said true?
That's absolutely right.
In particular,
right.
The hippocampus,
which
is where your memory is.
That's right. It's just behind, kind of, if I could take my finger and put it in my ear, we're sort of getting close on each side to your hippocampus. And what that is important.
Don't do that in the studio, please.
Right. Can't get there. But what it was important is because this region is not only important to memory, it does seem to be a biomarker, a biological marker that relates to the early changes that put you at risk for Alzheimer's disease. And Alzheimer's disease is becoming more and more well known for an age-related public health epidemic. And if we can find, we don't have a current cure, but if we can find ways that are easy and largely scalable that allow older adults to essentially remain engaged rather than retire and progressively become more sedentary, we're finding a way in which they give back to their community, but at the same time, we can show through the brain studies that maybe we're doing something that actually can reverse aging to some degree.
So this is better than just reading or doing crossword puzzles, playing bridge or poker with your friends. Compared to the things people do perhaps that are more sedentary, mm-hmm, in retirement, mm-hmm, being engaged with, especially maybe with children, mm-hmm, is shakes the cobwebs, as they say, and mm-hmm, is better for the brain?
Well, it's a great question that I can't unpack it fully because our program encompasses so many components. So we don't know what it is about the program and whether it is the engagement with children. That's the critical magic ingredient. I believe there's something about the social engagement. We're wired to be social as human beings, and that doesn't change as we get older. But with regard to crossword puzzles, I can tell you the evidence to date does not support the same benefits we're seeing. And in fact, what you find is when you do crossword puzzles or any kind of game, you only get better at that game. You don't get better at anything else. It doesn't generalize to your ability to drive or to manage your medications.
That's very interesting. I mean, this is important stuff that you're doing here because we're living longer. And living longer, mm-hmm, is great, but it comes with the risks of developing Alzheimer's, right?
That's right. The paradox of aging is if you live to 65, then you see an increasing risk for dementia.
Yeah. So you think you've got a pretty good argument here for civic engagement for retired people. It, not enough just to read, do crossword puzzles, take a walk, talk to a friend now and then. more that you right. need to do more than that. Is that
right.
what comes out of this for you?
That's right. And in fact, it's not just that you need to, you may want to. So a lot of our volunteers, whether they be the control or in the program, and I'd like to thank them. I'd like to shout out it, without them, we couldn't do this work and our many funders. But I think the message is not that we need to, but that actually we want to. We're appealing to a natural human desire. And in doing that, it's not like exercise regimens right now. And we know right at this point that exercise is good for not only our brain, but our body. But none of us really does it in the doses that we're asked to, which is 90 minutes a week of moderate intensity exercise. What if we actually found that doing this and getting out of bed and walking in and out of schools and getting in and out of little chairs and engaging with the kids actually was sufficient to engender the same benefits?
That's pretty cool stuff. You have a reason to get out of bed each of those days. Michelle Carlson, Associate Professor in the Department of Mental Health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and member of the core faculty at the JHU Center on Aging and Health, has been talking with us about her study on civic engagement, maybe staving off brain atrophy and improving memory as you get older. That's great stuff, Michelle. Nice to have you on the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Please enjoy lunch. We have lunch from Bagby Pizza Company for our guests here on the Midday Show. Hope you enjoyed our first hour. Please stick around for the second hour of the show after the news from NPR.